Let's give Ken a Dallas welcome, shall we?
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to provide a text for a context for this message, and although this is by no means exegetical, this is somewhere between an academic paper and a sermon, and I'll leave it up to you to decide on which end of the spectrum it violates. James 1:27, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. This may be the verse that caused Luther to regard James as an epistle of straw, or one of the verses, but if we believe this is inspired by the Holy Spirit, then if you knew that the Holy Spirit was going to basically tell you that true religion could be boiled down to two things, I think you'd pay attention. I don't think that this text means that our concern for the world is only limited to looking after orphans and widows. I think that's a symbol of a greater level of concern that we would have. And what I'd like you, just to keep this text in mind as I give my talk, what I'd like you to entertain is the idea that orphans and widows in this text is a phrase to suggest people who in some way are deprived of a supportive order of things that God has originally intended for them in creation. That in an unfallen world there would be no orphans and widows. That there's a natural good in having fathers and husbands. And not just a good that is of material benefit. But I'd like to suggest that half of the text does call us to look for ways in which people's lives are dehumanized, and that's the principal theme of my talk today. To also, by way of introduction, since this is going to get a little deep at points, but to give you something to hang on to show that there's some contemporary relevance, you always bring a newspaper into the pulpit here. I was really struck, yesterday's Wall Street Journal, big story, E-tail gets derailed, how web upstarts misjudge the game. Turns out E-tailing isn't everything it was thought to be. That people selling things online are actually in for a relatively rough ride. There's something about it that's not working. Today's USA Today, which has slipped under the door at my hotel, one school's quantum leap. In Florida, a class of 2004 will do all its learning online. And I looked at that this morning, I thought, wait a minute. This is telling us that there's something about the internet that doesn't work the way people had hoped it would, even though billions of dollars have been invested in it. And meanwhile, we've got this optimism about the possibility of digital education. It's interesting to note over here, internet executives unloading stock. It turns out that these guys saw it coming and left the rest of us suckers holding their stock. But anyway, you'll see the relevance of this to James, I hope, in a few minutes. The February 2000 issue of Wired magazine, that fat, hyper-designed parcel of techno-porn, featured a cover story by one Kevin Warwick called Cyborg 1.0. Kevin Warwick outlines his plan to become one with his computer. In the article, Mr. Warwick described the elaborate implants he's installing into his body, implants with miniature transmitters that link up various signals from his nervous system and other bodily activities with his PC. He's thus able to monitor, record, and play back a range of experiences, and to use his PC not only as a biofeedback device, but to initiate certain pre-programmed biological responses. His wife is going to have some similar implants, and since their computers are networked, this may, I suppose, bring them closer. Kevin Warwick declares near the beginning of the article, "I was born human, But this was an accident of fate, a condition merely of time and space. Keep that phrase in mind. This is merely a condition of time and space. I believe it's something we have the power to change. Human, for Kevin Warwick, and presumably for at least some of the avid readers of Wired, is a transitional, disposable state which can be transcended through acts of will, imagination, and technology. Warwick's cyborg project fits the description of what scholar Catherine Hales describes as an emerging post-human point of view. In her 1999 book, How We Became Post-Human, Virtual Bodies in Cybernetics, Literature, and Informatics, Hales observes that the post-human view sees human experience in terms of information more than material existence. The post-human view sees embodiment, quote, as an accident of history rather than in an inevitability of life. The post-human view thinks of the body as the original prosthesis we all learn to manipulate, so that extending or replacing the body with other prostheses becomes a continuation of a process that began before we were born. Most important, by these and other means, the post-human view configures human being so that it can be seamlessly articulated with intelligent machines. In the post-human view, there are no essential differences or absolute demarcations between bodily existence and computer simulation, cybernetic mechanism and biological organism, robot teleology, and human goals. In another recent book that came out just this year called Becoming a Cosmopolitan, What It Means to Be a Human in the New Millennium, which is the sort of title that I immediately have to buy this book and read it and see what this person is saying. It's written by a philosophy professor named Jason Hill, and he demonstrates similarly fluid hopes, although he's not interacting with his PC as intimately, at least not according to the book. Where Warwick wants to amend his existence and leave behind his humanity, Hill insists that humanity implies necessarily an ever-changing identity. The human project, writes Dr. Hill, is truly one of self-creation, of making ourselves into as many as we can of the different kinds of beings we can possibly be. Hill celebrates the modern tendency to elevate becoming over being with an enthusiastic voraciousness. And as I was reading this next paragraph, I kept asking myself, what did his third grade teacher do? As a self in becoming, or as an aspirant intent on embracing becoming as a moral imperative, I am moved by a maniacal will, by a vision of a heightened form of existence, and again by a surge of movement, of restlessness, of a desire to create myself over and over. Because I am a self in becoming, my ruling emotions are dissatisfaction and a gnawing sense of incompleteness. This is a good thing, by the way. Okay? Don't forget, this is a good thing. The self in becoming is an eclectic, honorable thief in relation to ideas, to the world, and to socialization. All must be put in the service of this hunger for completion. Appropriation, when governed by scrupulous means, a nice little caveat there, although he doesn't explain how that would be the case, becomes a moral imperative. Failure to appropriate means complacency, stagnation, and eventual burial under the musty debris of dated labels and the weight of cultural traditions that are two sizes too small for the enormity of a hungry and ever-expanding soul. The self in becoming faces the world it has inherited with a yawn and a sigh. Is that all there is? Later in the book, Hill describes his notion of the self as a transcendent chooser with an apparently godlike will. He insists that the self is at base nothing but a capacity to put into question all that is alleged to be unalterable. As I was reading these two accounts, I realized that they both reminded me in different ways of the Borg. If you've watched Star Trek: The Next Generation, you know this incredibly hostile race who are hybrids of biological and mechanico-cybernetic beings. They're people with too many implants. They're also thieves in relation to ideas and to just about everything else, though not honorable thieves. They relentlessly roam the galaxy appropriating technologies from other races whom they then annihilate. Before the Borg, resistance is futile. And they seem to do nothing but steal. They have no lives beyond assimilating. It's a picture of the triumph of the pure will to power with no end to be served beyond the acquisition of power. Kevin Warwick's experiment, which also resonates with the Borg quite immediately, the cybernetic implants and the aspiration to a collective network in which his wife recedes as a person as she is perceived in terms of data known better by her PC than by a person. But Jason Hill's vision is also like the Borg in an ever deeper way. He doesn't, to my knowledge, aspire to be as on such intimate terms with his PC, but his perpetually restless acquisition of new identity is just as depersonalizing. For he neither is nor has a persona, at least not for long. As a maniacal will, he's faceless and homeless. He is a self-described cosmopolitan, a citizen of everywhere and of nowhere, and I'm not sure that he would make a very good neighbor. But Hill insists that such a restless existence is the very meaning of being human today. Now, beyond the associations with the Star Trek Borg, what else do these two voices have in common? One is interested in evolving into a new life form through technical prostheses. The other seems unconcerned with physical aspects of existence altogether and is eager to assert a version of moral freedom. One sees himself leaving his humanity behind, the other believes he's fulfilling it. What they have in common is a view of the self which exalts the will as the ultimate attribute. Finally, an attribute which negates all others. For Jason Hill, to be human is to have a sovereign, unencumbered will. For Kevin Warwick, fulfillment as a post-human being is again an act of will, unrestrained neither by physical barriers nor by cultural conventions. I'd like to suggest today that these two voices, which are representative of many contemporary philosophies, cultural trends, and social movements, actually represent neither the fulfilling of human personality and freedom, nor the transcending of human identity itself, but really the destruction of human nature. They're part of a long-standing project in Western history that pursues a self without limits and without a nature, a project which C.S. Lewis termed the abolition of man. Until recently, however, the rhetoric of humanism, of a high and noble identity to human being, prevailed in public life. So the charge that a particular activity was dehumanizing or depersonalizing was one that tended to have the moral high ground. Now, in many academic circles, such language would be regarded as a quaint vestige of pre-modern and modern naivete, if not a kind of male chauvinism. And in public life at large, one doesn't encounter the same level of moral outrage at the prospect of something being inherently depersonalizing. C.S. Lewis's concerns about the abolition of man, and I hope you'll forgive my use of his term despite its rhetorical incorrectness, Lewis's concerns were published in 1947, when the memories of Nazi crimes against humanity were still frighteningly fresh, and when the parallel track of Stalin's political project were just being acknowledged in the West. We have neither ovens nor gulags to stimulate a defense of the human. There are contemporary atrocities, but they tend to happen in Africa, and so they're very easily ignored for us. But we do have very lively questions about the meaning of the human that should stimulate greater discussion, if not greater passion. Until recently, however, the rhetoric of humanism, of a high and noble identity to human being, prevailed in public life. So the charge that a particular activity was dehumanizing or depersonalizing was one that tended to have the moral high ground. Now, in many academic circles, such language would be regarded as a quaint vestige of pre-modern and modern naivete, if not a kind of male chauvinism. And in public life at large, one doesn't encounter the same level of moral outrage at the prospect of something being inherently depersonalizing. C.S. Lewis's concerns about the abolition of man, and I hope you'll forgive my use of his term despite its rhetorical incorrectness, Lewis's concerns were published in 1947, when the memories of Nazi crimes against humanity were still frighteningly fresh, and when the parallel track of Stalin's political project were just being acknowledged in the West. We have neither ovens nor gulags to stimulate a defense of the human. There are contemporary atrocities, but they tend to happen in Africa, and so they're very easily ignored for us. But we do have very lively questions about the meaning of the human that should stimulate greater discussion, if not greater passion. We have philosopher Peter Singer, recently appointed chair in bioethics at Princeton University's Center for Human Values. It will probably be renamed the Center for Post-Human Values soon. Singer would like us to accept infanticide and euthanasia as sometimes morally obligatory. We have the imminent prospect of human cloning, which has caused only a flicker of public interest, though it is an event of unprecedented moral moment. We have very soon the possibility of extensive genetic manipulation, which will allegedly allow parents to construct a designer baby. We have, in fact, a long list of moral and cultural issues that have at their core questions about the meaning of the human, from heated issues like abortion, gender change operations, and same-sex marriage, to virtually invisible issues like the expansion of factory farming, the rise of so-called distance learning, and the effects on community life of a globalized economy. All of these involve some vision of what it means to be human. Unlike Lewis, we have no Hitlers or Stalins casting lengthening dark shadows, but we do have Kevin Warwick and Jason Hill. We do have numerous voices in the academy who champion an anti-humanism or who speak sometimes ominously of the post-human. I've even heard of someone with an endowed chair in the post-humanities, a person whose job description or mission statement I'd love to read sometime. But like Lewis, we see the same symbiotic patterns of thought and action which, working together, destroy any idea of the human. Two patterns which are increasingly evident, but which have been part of the West for some time. One, which I've suggested already, is an exaltation of the will. The other is the denigration of the body. And you can see how these two patterns are related. The body is a limiting factor in human experience. We all know this. It is tied to space and time, to history and to community, in a way that thwarts the will sometimes. If the will is to succeed in its project of self-exaltation, it must silence the claims of embodiment. And yet, as I hope to show, embodiment is an essential aspect of our being. So to despise the body is intrinsically dehumanizing. But positively, if we can recover a perspective on the body that are rooted in the biblical account of our origins both in the dust of the earth and in the breath of God, a biblical account of our place within the creation and before God, and of Christian ideas of incarnation and resurrection, if we can recover such a perspective and strive to act in accordance with it, personally and socially, we will do a great deal to enrich and sustain a view of the human that will be a profound act of loving our neighbors. It will be a profound way to care for widows and orphans in their distress. In the past, under the influence of Greek prejudices against the material world, Christians have too often given the impression that our salvation is a means of deliverance from our humanity rather than a restoration of our humanity. Paul Marshall has observed that much Christian teaching and preaching regards believers as apprentice angels, eagerly awaiting transport to an extra bodily life. But it is as embodied men and women that we are saved, and it is as embodied men and women that we will enjoy our glorification. The creed that is recited in most Christian churches throughout the world on Sunday says, "I believe in the resurrection of the body," not "I believe in the immortality of the soul." We share our human being with our Savior. There's nothing essential to human nature that can be despised or rejected. In this past, in my lifetime, for decades in the 20th century, conservative Christians assumed that the word humanism was always a bad thing. And J.I. Packer and Thomas Howard were more on the mark when they entitled a 1985 book, which they co-wrote, Christianity, the True Humanism. Given the nature of the times, Christians may soon be the only humanists left, if they're true to biblical teaching and insist that being human means something rather than nothing or everything. There's a great opportunity and a diaconal need for contemporary Christian humanism that would be committed to exploring what being human means in great detail, and then to a prophetic alertness to and resistance of all the ways in which our cultural lives are dehumanizing. So a Christian humanism would involve a deliberate effort to understand and live out the fullest consequences of the meaning of our divinely given humanity and the rejection of cultural forms that fail to do justice to who we are as embodied image bearers of our Creator. Now, more on this in a moment. I want to take the time to do a little history lesson, and this is the densest part. The abolition of any notion of a fixed human nature may seem like a rather odd chapter in the story of Western culture, especially of modern Western culture. If we think of the Renaissance as the birth time of the modern way of viewing the cosmos, and we think of Renaissance humanism as the fulcrum that established a point of leverage to usher in this new way of seeing reality, it's ironic that humanism should give rise to its antithesis. And yet, even in the earliest expressions of Italian humanism, we see the stage set for a drama of moral inversion. In the thinking of some of the leading 15th century humanists, by the way, a footnote here, the reason I'm going back to this is it's really important for us to see how deeply entrenched in our culture these ideas are. This isn't something that just happened with the 60s. This is a 500-year mistake, 500-year-old mistake that I think we have to remedy. In the thinking of some of the leading 15th century humanists, human dignity was predicated on the grounds of an absolute human freedom. Rather than seeing human worth and honor rooted in the structure of a God-given nature, these seminal thinkers asserted that humanity's brightness was a function of a dynamic human will restricted by no nature at all. Take, for example, Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, whose landmark Oration on the Dignity of Man was presented in 1487. In the oration, Pico offers an account of creation, a kind of supplement to the Genesis story, in which God informs the newly made Adam, and Pico is writing as a professing Christian with the blessing of the church, although there was some suspicion about him. God informs the newly made Adam that he has a unique place, man has a unique place in the cosmos. Quote, "We have given you, O Adam, no visage proper to yourself, nor any endowment properly your own, in order that whatever place, whatever form, whatever gifts you may, with premeditation, select, these same you may have and possess through your own judgment and decision. The nature of all other creatures is defined and restricted within laws which we have laid down. You, by contrast, impeded by no such restrictions, may, by your own free will, to whose custody we have assigned you, trace for yourself the lineaments of your own nature." In other words, God is saying to Adam, I've made you free to be whatever you want to be. "I've placed you at the very center of the world so that from that vantage point you may with greater ease glance around you on all the world contains. We have made you a creature neither of heaven nor of earth, neither mortal nor immortal, in order that you may, as the free and proud shaper of your own being, fashion yourself in the form you may prefer." The first time I read this, I was kind of shocked. It read like Shirley MacLaine or something. But this is kind of the foundations of the Renaissance. Pico later makes it clear in good Neoplatonic fashion that this freedom to define oneself is best exerted by the contemplative who disdains all bodily existence, seeking godlike knowledge and power through the exercise of magic, of power over creation in magical ways. Now, similarly, Marsilio Ficino's Platonic theology, which was printed first in 1482, presents an argument that man is a terrestrial god. Quote, "The entire striving of our soul is that it become God. Such striving is no less natural to men than the effort to flight is to birds. And later, after describing the godlike power over creation which is possible for man, he makes another exceptional claim. The immense magnificence of our soul may manifestly be seen from this, that he will not be satisfied with the empire of this world if, having conquered this one, he learns that there remains another world which he is not yet subjugated. Thus, man wishes no superior and no equal and will not permit anything to be left out and excluded from his rule. This status belongs to God alone. Therefore, he seeks a divine condition. Ficino later asserts that man has the power to acquire knowledge, even to change fate, to change his own destiny. Now, Ficino and Pico were writing from an ostensibly Christian position. It's clear they were influenced by Gnostic sources. Their view of the propriety of human aspiration to godlike knowledge and power flatly contradicts the account of the fall, in which the desire for godlike knowledge is the origin of sin. As I've suggested, this early modern picture of human possibility plants the seed for the eventual denial of human nature. The West began increasingly, from this time on, to value man's becoming over man's being, to value human possibilities over human actualities. And finally, in the interest of total liberation of the will, the West has come to a position of skepticism about human being altogether. Now, C.S. Lewis saw this coming. He saw where it was leading, because he understood that the modern project of acquiring absolute control over nature, a possibility that arises in the 15th century, required that we had to deny that there is any nature to nature. That is, we had to deny that reality in its moral and metaphysical order was established by God. Rather, the stuff of nature was chaotic and meaningless, without form and void, and was awaiting human activity to render it meaningful in whatever way human will desired. And in a famous passage in his book, The Abolition of Man, Lewis observed that the alchemists and the astrologers of the High Renaissance had a great deal in common with modern science and technology, in that they both assumed the possibility of ultimate power over the stuff of the universe, and they both assumed that human will gave the universe meaning. Here's the passage. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. Lewis observed somewhere else that you can't go against the grain of the universe without getting splinters. An easier passage to understand for us. That was reflecting the old view, the view that there's a givenness in the structure of the creation, and that human well-being required a recognition of the order of things that God had established in creation, and then a training and restraining of desire so as to fit within the order of the reality. But the modern view says there is no grain, and therefore there can't be any splinters. We are terrestrial gods, and we construct the pattern of reality to satisfy our desire. But as Lewis saw in The Abolition of Man, and what gives it its title, is the fact that when one sets out to deny the structure of nature in the interest of expanding human choice, one ends up having to deny the nature of human nature. We only have to look at government-sponsored reflection on the ethics of human cloning to see that we have come to that point, or are very close to it, in which freedom is seen as serving no higher end than itself. Our society is increasingly committed to the expansion of the range of choice at the expense of assessing the merits of specific choices. But no vision of human freedom that excludes a rich and rooted meaning to human can long preserve freedom worth the name. Human freedom is always freedom within the boundaries of the human. But boundaries are precisely what many champions of freedom despise. Boundedness, on the Christian view, characterizes our nature. Our embodiment is a signal of that fact, and any species of angelism, of denying the limits of our existence, as well as of the grain of the universe, will end up in a dehumanizing tyranny and destructiveness. The biblical story of human being affirms that boundedness in its picture of the life of human beings in this world. We live as embodied creatures of a particular nature, in a particular kind of place, and all of it received in its boundedness a divine benediction on the sixth day of creation. As rebellious creatures, we are more enchanted by the possibilities of worlds of our own creation. We want to reorder space and time, to treat time as a mere commodity rather than the form of our existence, to eliminate the meaning and significance of matter itself, if possible, to reconfigure our own biology and the structure of all around us so as to satisfy and exalt our own wills. And vast technical, commercial, and political energies are expended in honoring our desire to eliminate all limits. But we are creatures of body and spirit, and to be embodied means to be limited and to be needy. That's the state in which we were created, as limited and needy creatures, and it was the state upon which God pronounced his benediction. It was a good thing that we were limited and needy. The first thing God does, the first thing God tells Adam is about where the food is. He creates him as a hungry being and then says, by the way, are there all these trees over here which are source of your food? And Jesus, the man Jesus, in his human nature was also limited and hungry. After the resurrection, in addition to making breakfast on the beach for his disciples, he asked for a piece of fish one night because he was hungry. Now, Christian humanism can recognize and resist the dehumanizing tendencies of our time only by affirming the goodness of an ordered and bounded creation, and particularly the goodness of embodiment. But the church has a very bad track record on this. It has been more Greek than Hebrew in its attitude toward the body. In a profound and somewhat painful essay on how cultural disorder rises out of a despising of the body, the poet farmer Wendell Berry laments the church's Gnostic temptations as follows. For many of the churchly, the life of the spirit is reduced to a dull preoccupation with getting to heaven. At best, the world is no more than an embarrassment and a trial to the spirit, which is otherwise radically separated from it. The true lover of God must not be burdened with any care for or respect for his works. As far as this sort of religion is concerned, the body is no more than the lusterless container of the soul, a mere package that will nevertheless light up in eternity, forever cool and shiny as a neon cross. This separation of the soul from the body and from the world is no disease of the fringe, no aberration, but a fracture that runs through the mentality of institutional religion like a geologic fault. And this rift in the mentality of religion continues to characterize the modern mind, no matter how secular or worldly it became. Paul says that we're to glorify God in our bodies. We're to present our bodies a living sacrifice, and yet the church, under the influence again of Greek thought, ignoring biblical teaching, I think, on the goodness of embodiment, the church has an atrophied theology of the meaning of embodiment. There are some hopeful signs. In some corners of thought and life here and there, there are indications of a countercultural recovery of meaning for the human rooted in embodiment, both in the church and even by the providence of God in the academy. In secular scholarship, there's greater interest, much of it admittedly confused and disordered, but there's greater interest in the meaning of embodiment. For example, sociologist Brian Turner of Cambridge has established what might be called a new sociological discipline, which is sometimes referred to as a sociology of the body. Turner's concerned with the place of the body in social structure and in the forming of consciousness and identity. Our embodiment, he argues, must be taken into account in the creation and maintenance of social and political institutions and in the effort to form systems of meaning about ourselves and the trajectory of our lives. After all, persons are born, they must eat, they suffer periodic bouts of frailty, they pursue meaning and pleasure through work and leisure in the world, they engage in relationships with one another, and all of these things they do in their bodies. And generally, sociology has tended to ignore the fact that they do these things in bodies. In an age enchanted by the possibilities of virtual reality and tempted by the unprecedented power to reconfigure the experience of human embodiment through technical means, the reality and significance of our embodiment does require more sustained attention, not only from sociologists, but from theologians. At a recent conference, Dr. Turner commented with some embarrassment on the newness of the discipline of the sociology of the body.
It's in a way remarkable that sociologists have not, until relatively recently, given much sustained attention to the range of issues linked to embodiment. Yet in other ways, it's not all that surprising, because theologians have been at least as delinquent, and we should have had a head start. After all, Christianity believes in the creation of human bodies by God, in the taking of a human body by God, in the resurrection of Christ's body, in the eating of Christ's body by his people, and in the resurrection of our bodies for eternal life. Everywhere you look in the biblical account, there are bodies and dimensions of embodiment. And yet, it's only in the last 30 or 40 years that a theology of the body has emerged as a serious and sustained discipline. When I started doing research on this a couple of years ago, I thought, well, gee, if we looked at some theology of the humanity of Jesus, since the church has been insistent from day one on asserting the humanity of Jesus and defending it, maybe we'll get some insight into the meaning of our own humanity. And I looked almost in vain for any evangelical works on the humanity of Christ until I found Nigel Cameron at Trinity Seminary, who observed that evangelicals never wrote much about the humanity of Jesus because liberals never denied it. In fact, they rather thought too much of it. So I'm hoping for some liberal to deny it so we'll do some good scholarship about it. There are other theologians who are reflecting more carefully on the way in which Christian discipleship involves orienting our lives to be in proper relation to our Creator and to the myriad forms of created reality. Colin Gunton in England, in his important book, The One, the Three, and the Many, which is attempting to understand creation from a Trinitarian point of view, argues that because we're created in the image of a triune God, we're created for communion. To be a human being, he writes, is to be created in and for relationships with God and with other human beings. And since we're embodied creatures, placed by God in a world of space and time, our communion takes place in a particular kind of world. The sort of Christian humanism I'm suggesting would look in detail at how our nature regulates in some ways the various forms of our engagement with creation, not just at the obviously problematic issues like euthanasia or self-defined gender. But there are also many issues about how we relate to place, how we relate to time, to history, to tradition, how we obey the fifth commandment as embodied creatures in honoring our father and mother by taking community seriously, by recovering a holistic view of sexuality and marriage, by insisting on the meaningful nature of work, and by opposing economic and technical developments that degrade work, and by reaffirming the relationships between human identity, body, and community. Let me close with a final example of the kind of perspective I believe a Christian humanism engenders. Forbes magazine recently published a special issue dedicated to a single topic, one that they called the biggest issue of our age, time. Here's how they introduce the subject. Quote, "We've beaten, or at least stymied, most of humanity's monsters." Here are the monsters: disease, climate, geography, and memory. But time still defeats us. Lately, its victories seem more complete than ever. Those time-saving inventions of the last half century have somehow turned on us. We now hold cell phone meetings in traffic jams. And 24/7 has become the most terrifying phrase in modern life. It's a pretty rich paragraph. One could learn a lot about contemporary culture by analyzing its assumptions. Why, for example, is time, not to mention geography and memory, regarded as a monster? Perhaps because time and place and memory in some way limit us. They must be monstrous since it's bad to be limited. Never mind the fact that God created us to thrive within limits and that our living in time and space and history are good things and that the incarnation involves the sinless God-man entering space and time. Time is not a monster, though our culture tends to see it as such. Sin and death do mean that time has an edge to it that was not meant to be there. But if we didn't live in time, we could not enjoy music, for music requires duration and rhythm. If we did not live in time, we couldn't enjoy the pleasure of anticipation and the rewards of growth. Time and space are the good, divinely created matrix, the good fabric of our existence, not evil bonds. Sin brings death, which means that our time in this mortal body is limited. But the promise of eternal life is a promise of finally defeating the power of death, of receiving resurrection bodies, and of enjoying space and time as we were intended to. But we order our lives around restless attitudes and habits toward time. James Gleick observed in his recent book called Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything, that many technologies we develop to help us save time merely encourage us to try to do more things and thus feel more hurried. This is again, I submit, a byproduct of regarding human desire rather than the order and limitedness of creation as a guide for human behavior. And it's finally dehumanizing. The Christian humanism, I imagine, has to reunite the theology of redemption with the theology of creation. The church has often been tempted to separate the message of salvation from the story of creation. I believe one of the reasons our culture is in such a sorry state is that Christian people have been culturally inert, and in large measure because their view of creation was more Greek than biblical. But perhaps the contemporary confusion about human nature will stimulate the church to articulate more thoroughly than ever before the remarkably rich significance of the doctrine of God the Creator. Creation and redemption belong together, for someday, as Paul insists in Romans 8, the creation itself will be liberated from bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. And on that day, our humanity will be fulfilled as we enter a place prepared for us by the God-man, Jesus Christ. Thank you very much. Thank you.